Welcome to this week's interview on Electric Theater Radio Hour with candidate for Texas House District 14, Bill Sargent. Well, listeners, as you know, it is political season, and you're going to be hearing a lot of candidates in the next few weeks. And then after that, once it's winnowed out and the primaries are done, then we're going to be hearing from the people that are actually running. Today, we have Bill Sargent. He's running for District 14 in the U.S. House, Ron Paul's former seat. Bill, welcome to Electric Theater Radio Hour.
Thank you.
What can we expect differently with Mr. Sargent in that seat as opposed to Mr. Paul?
Mr. Paul, or Ron, and I have some things in common, but some things that are not in common. Some of the things we have in common is that we were involved with the beginning or the rebirth of the conservative movement in this country back in the 1960s. He was a member of Young Americans for Freedom, so was I. So we come from the same kind of a background in some ways. I would say that that Ron Paul has a lot of very good ideas as it relates to the to his domestic policy. Foreign policy-wise, I think we would separate in some areas. I think it makes a whole lot of sense not to give money or not borrow money to give money in foreign aid to countries that don't agree with us. You remember the Beatles?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you remember Can't Buy Me Love? Well,
yes.
same idea. Okay?
Yes.
If you want to rely on someone as a friend, it can't be based on the fact that you're paying them to be a friend, because mm-hmm. you can't count on that. At the same time, I believe that the only friend we have in the Middle East is Israel. I would support Israel. When I say that, I don't mean that I would be in favor of just giving like a block grant and say, here's a bunch of money, go spend it. But I would think it would make sense to come up alongside them, you know, on defense projects or whatever, and to work with them. I think it is wrong for the United States to say to Israel, you need to give back the West Bank. I think it's wrong to say that, you know, you should split Jerusalem again. You know, that's their country at this point. And who are we to interject our position on them? And I think, you know, that happened under Bush, it's happened under Carter, it's happened under all kinds of presidents, and I think that's wrong.
Especially when they're probably our staunchest ally, certainly in that region. They're critical to stability in that region.
I don't know where you're coming from spiritually, but Scripture says very clearly, God says, I will bless those people who bless my people, and I will curse those who curse them. What we've been doing is cursing them. So if we want our country to be blessed, we'd better change that policy.
Well, let's hope we do. You're not a libertarian.
No, sir. Let me go back a ways. As I said earlier, I was there for the rebirth of the conservative movement in the 1960s. I was in California. I was a member of Young Americans for Freedom. I was there at the National Convention in 1964. I was one of the organizers of the largest youth rally for Barry Goldwater at that convention. The speaker at that rally was a little-known actor who then became the governor of California, then became the president of the United States. We're talking about Ronald Reagan. Now, what did Barry Goldwater stand for? Barry Goldwater's policies were a strong national defense, support for the free market economy, and individual liberty. Barry Goldwater, of course, did not win that election. But then about 15, 20 years later, Mr. Reagan did win. What did Mr. Reagan do? He implemented Barry Goldwater's policies, a strong national defense, support for the free market economy, individual liberties. What did we see during the Reagan administration? We saw the end of the Cold War. We saw the economy burst forth. Those policies make sense. That's where I'm coming from.
The fact that you were there at the time is Reagan was like a delayed reaction to Goldwater, because Reagan could put forth the conservative philosophy in a way that more people could understand and relate to. So much of it was Barry Goldwater. He was carrying on his work, basically.
And he was implementing his policy.
Yes, and Goldwater was a little irascible, and of course, when Johnson ran those ads basically saying, do you know, he's a nutcase and he's going to hit the button and we'll be in a nuclear war, very unfair, but people bought it, enough people to win in a landslide. However, as you pointed out, we've seen time and results have proven that Goldwater was right, and oddly enough, we've veered away from all that yet again.
Well, there's a difference, though. We have a lot of nice people running for office for the seat that I'm looking for. But there's a big difference between us. One of those differences has to do with my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before I go into the experience, let me tell you a story, a true story. Back in 1860, there was a man who was elected to Congress from California. He lived in Nevada City, California. He went down to San Francisco Bay, got on a steamer, went down to Panama, crossed over the isthmus, and went back on a steamer up to Washington, D.C. to serve as a congressman in 1860. On that trip, he was befriended by what we would today call a lobbyist. And the lobbyist he was with was a guy who was representing the Big Four, the railroad interest in California. When he got there as a freshman member of Congress, he introduced the Transcontinental Railroad Bill. That bill became law. Many years later, he then introduced as a freshman senator, he introduced the first resolution calling for the women to have the right to vote. He never saw that take place. He was a friend of Susan B. Anthony. They had all kinds of correspondence, which is still in Nevada City in the Searles Library if someone wanted to go look at it. He never saw it happen because he died before that amendment was passed to the Constitution. That man was my great-grandfather, Aaron Augustus Sargent.
Whoa, I'll be.
Okay, so my involvement, this man I never knew because he died before I was born. I've heard that story all my life, how he stood up for something and how he didn't just let things go by. He took the bull by the horns and got the job done. That was important to me. I have over 20 years experience on Capitol Hill. No other candidate has that background. You know, when I say I have 20 years experience on Capitol Hill, I'm not a career politician. This is the first time I've ever run for office. But I worked for two congressmen. I worked for Senator Jesse Helms for a period of time. And then I went to work for the Commerce Department for over 18 years, doing trade legislation for them on both the House and the Senate side.
Trade legislation?
Yes, sir. I jokingly say, I know where the men's rooms are. I don't have to go find them. I know the pitfalls that members fall into. One member of Congress that I work for wanted to be on the Commerce Committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee. He went to the ranking congressman who was, because the Republicans were in the minority at that point, the congressman who was the ranking member said to him, Lou, we'd love to have you on this committee. But as part of that deal, if I ever call you and say, I need your vote, I expect you to vote with me. And he said, yes. If I was given that choice, I would say no, because that's giving up my integrity. Integrity is very important to me. I run the elections process here in Galveston currently. And when we start programming the ballots, I'm going to take a leave of absence from that because it's inappropriate to have that job.
Yes.
And run for office. I have people from the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party saying what a wonderful job we're doing down in Galveston. Why? Because we treat everybody the same. We don't deal with people one way if they're one party or one color or whatever. Everybody gets a fair shake. Integrity is the name of the game for me. When the Justice Department came to us relating to redistricting, or came to the county judge and said, we want to know all the statistics about who got elected for the last 10 years and what the votes were, I had no problem in providing that. But when they asked me to tell them what ethnicity was of each candidate, I went back to the county judge and I said, listen, Mark, here's what we're going to do. If you want me to provide that information, I want something in writing from the Department of Justice directing me to give them that information because I don't know what the ethnicity is. And if I was one of the persons on the other end of the phone being asked that question, I would be offended. I don't think that. People are people. You treat people as people. You don't treat them because of where they come from, what their background is, or anything else. You treat them with respect. I don't care who they are. That's really important to me.
Boy, you really know the behind-the-scenes ramifications of these things, being around Washington, D.C., and in the House chambers and all that, plus here at the voting level.
Let me tell you the kind of congressman I want to be. I want to be a congressman like my great-grandfather was. But also, let me tell you another story. When I was in Washington, I went to a church, and we had a vacation Bible study or Bible school. My role in that was because I worked on Capitol Hill. They asked me to take these 20 12-year-olds and have them meet with members of Congress who were Christians and have them talk about their Christian walk. And well, the congressman who was our congressman was Frank Wolf. Frank Wolf is still there. I've known him for years. And so we set it up. And before that, I went by and talked to Jack Kemp's office because I know Jack for a long time. And I said, you know, to his scheduler, can Jack make it? Because Jack was a very strong believer and a wonderful man. she said, "Sarge, we can't do that because he's got three other things he's got to do and it won't work out." So I said, "Well, okay, fine. That's, you know, I kind of expected that, not a problem." So the day of the event came, and there was Frank Wolf in the Veterans Affairs Committee room talking to these 20 kids. In walks Jack Kemp. Now, Jack Kemp walked in. Of course, they knew he was the quarterback for the Buffalo Bills. They knew he was a congressman. He spent a half hour with those kids. And I walked out with him. I said, "Jack, I really appreciate you doing this." And he looked me right in the eye and he said, "Sarge, this is the most important thing I could be doing at this time." He said, "The other things could be put aside, but these are going to be the leaders of our country. The people who are going to be out voting someday and who will remember this because not because I'm important, but because of what I had to say about my walk with the Lord. You know, that's more important." Jack Kemp came from New York State. These kids were from Northern Virginia. There's no way they or any of their parents would get, you know, Jack would get any kind of votes out of this.
Right.
Jack was making a purposeful decision to do what was right. That's the kind of congressman I want to be.
That's an excellent story, and that's a great role model. That's a great example to follow. And when you said there he was, he showed up and he says, "Oh, well, no, this takes precedence. This is bigger than anything else I could be doing." I believe he ran in the primaries for president a couple of times.
No, he ran. He was once the vice presidential candidate, and he lost. Of course, he's passed now.
I had always thought he would make an excellent president, mainly because of his economic philosophy, and I just liked his approach. I thought he was an encyclopedia of knowledge.
Well, he had the same policies as Goldwater, as Reagan, all right, and he was a man of integrity. I look back at my years on the Hill, and there are a handful of people who have integrity. I can remember Donnie Fussell, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee on the House, Democrat from Florida. And I don't remember the exact issue that we were involved with, but I went to the chairman and I said, "Mr. Chairman, what we need you to do is X, Y, Z. Will you do that for us?" And he said, "Sarge, I'll do that for you." So I said, "Fine." We had a commitment from him. A couple weeks later, he came back to me and he said, "Sarge, I'm getting all kinds of pressure from the Speaker of the House." This is long before Pelosi. "I'm getting a lot of pressure from the Speaker of the House and the Democratic leadership not to do what I told you I'd do. You know, would it be okay if you release me from that promise?" And I said, "Mr. Chairman, there's no question. You know, you want to do that, that's fine. You know, it's not that big a deal. I'm happy to do that for you." But what did he do? He made a promise. When he figured out he couldn't keep it, he came back to the person he made a promise to, and he asked that person, "Will you release me from that promise?" If I had said no, he would have kept that promise, because I know him. Donnie Fussell was a man of honor. We've seen time after time where people don't keep their word. My word is my bond. What I promise, I will do, and if for some reason I cannot do that, I'll come back to the person I promised it to and say, "Will you release me?" Because that's the right thing to do.
It is the right thing to do, and unfortunately, it used to be the rule rather than the exception, and it seems like in the last 10 or 20 years, people have gotten away from that. They don't feel like their word means anything. So, "Well, I changed my mind," or, "Well, it turned out it didn't work for me." But once you give your word, you stick to it. I was taught that. It's very important, and it's probably more critical in politics than anywhere else.
Well, unfortunately, it's the rarity. Now, but I was talking about how I differ from the other nice folks who are running. That experience on Capitol Hill is a primary one. I'm not part of the problem. I see the pitfalls, and I'll see them ahead of time. When some of these people who are running have no idea what they're getting into. They've never been there. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, I live in the district. I live here on Galveston Island. My family lives here on Galveston Island. This is home for us. There are people who are running who don't live in the district, who, when asked, "Do you live in the district?" say, "Well, we don't really know where the district is going to be," and they hedge and hum and haw about it. That's being dishonest. If I didn't live in the district and someone asked me, "Do you live in the district?" my answer would have to be no, but I do live here. You've got to be truthful. You've got to tell the truth. It's not illegal to run for this office if you don't live in the district, as long as you move here after you get elected. And I applaud every single one of the people who's running. I mean, I've never run for office before, and I'm now seeing what it's like to run for office. It is not fun.
Yeah.
But it's something that's worthwhile if you're committed to getting a job done. And so I commend them for doing that. But at least tell the truth. Another thing that's different for me and other people is that there are a number of people running who are attorneys. Over a third of the people in Congress are attorneys.
God, I thought it was more than that.
Well, it's at least a third. And I come from a long line of attorneys. My great-grandfather was an attorney. His son was an attorney, who was my grandfather. My father was an attorney. So I have nothing, I don't have a problem with attorneys, but I think we have too many of them in Washington representing us. It's called the House of Representatives. That means we ought to have a broad cross-section of people representing us. Now, I have government experience. I'm a retired federal employee, but I also have a small business background. I mean, I served as a realtor and a broker in Northern Virginia. I was a member of the Million Dollar Sales Club there. One year working part-time, I became a top producer by selling 37 houses in one year, part-time.
Ooh, boy, the good old days, huh?
All right. So I mean, and I worked my tail off doing two jobs. I'm also the only person in this race who's a retired veteran. There's one person who's with the Coast Guard for a six-year term, joined up in 1961 as a seaman recruit. I took an oath of office when I joined up as a seaman recruit to support and defend the Constitution. I retired over 20 years later as lieutenant commander. But when I retired, I did not retire from that oath. That oath is still part of me, and it will be as long as I'm alive. Yeah, I've been in this race for 45 days. There are people who have been in this race for over 4 years, and they're running, and they've been waiting for the space to open up when Ron Paul retires so they can jump in and win the, you know, and get this position. That's not what it's about.
Well, what prompted you to step in?
Because I feel strongly that we need to return to the policies of Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp and those kinds of people. And we need to stop the way we're going. I mean, you look at what happened with Obamacare. If Obamacare is allowed to stand, then the federal government can do anything it wants in any part of your life and regulate it. And we can't afford to let that happen.
Well, and there's something incredibly scary about a House Speaker saying, oh, no, we need to pass it so we can see what's in it.
Right. Well,
that's frightening.
Let me tell you this. You know, we're talking about differences between me and other people in the race. I would say, and I think I'm correct, that I am the only candidate who's running who has had to deal with Nancy Pelosi one-on-one and deal with her. And it was when I was working for the Commerce Department, one of the things I did is I had to walk into Nancy Pelosi's office and deal with her on a couple of issues. I knew then I could not trust her. I still know I can't trust her. The whole world knows at this point you can't trust her. But I'm the only candidate who's experienced that.
Well, and that brings up a very interesting point, because I've often thought, you see a lot of people run, happening right now, but it happens all the time, and they come in and they go, well, I'm an outsider, and that's what we need. I learned that is a rough system there. And it has its own set of rules. And if you're a political novice, you're not likely to get anything done. You have to know how it works, that you've been around Washington, which is probably like another planet.
Well, let me put it to you this way. First of all, some people would say that I'm part of the problem because I work there. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my time with the Commerce Department was as a civil servant. The Republicans knew that I was Republican. The Democrats knew that, you know, I was a civil servant. When people in the administration would come to me and say, Bill, I want you to go up and do such and such, and it was political, I'd say, you know what, I think you really need to get somebody else, a political appointee, to do that. And the reason for that was that I knew as soon as I crossed over that line as opposed to civil servant, when I crossed over that line, my credibility would be shot and I would have no effectiveness on the Hill at all. But as it was, I never crossed that line. I could go up and talk to the staff people or the congressman or the chairman of a committee like Donnie Fussell or whatever, and they knew that I was telling them the truth and that they could rely on what I said as being truth. That was never questioned because they knew I was not going to step over that line. And I will not do that as a congressman. I'm not going to step over that line. I'm going to do what's right.
I'm just really still thinking about from when you first sat down and the experience you bring to this from so many different areas, but they're all relevant. Because sometimes they talk about, well, we need somebody young, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's a lot that comes with having been in and around life for a long time. You learn things, you develop wisdom.
A lot of what you're able to accomplish in Washington depends on what committee you're on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, people say, well, I'm going to go change the tax law. The chances are, as a freshman member, you're not going to be a part of the Ways and Means Committee. Now, I've dealt with the Ways and Means Committee on trade legislation, their trade subcommittee, for a number of years. I've known members who sat on that committee. You know, the chances are you're not going to sit on the Ways and Means Committee. Chances are you're not going to sit on the Rules Committee that controls how things go to the floor. Basically, what they try to do is they try to match you up with what fits your district. You know, but from my perspective, one of the issues we need to deal with on Capitol Hill is a balanced budget. Now, in doing that, there are a couple of things we need to keep in mind. First of all, it needs to be because we can't trust the Congress. And even after, while I'm there and after I leave, if I get elected, you know, we still won't be able to trust them because people are people. So we need to do it as an amendment to the Constitution. But we need to do it as an amendment to the Constitution in this way. One of the problems is you can balance the budget by raising taxes. We don't want to balance the budget by raising taxes. We want to balance the budget by reducing spending. We need to craft that amendment very carefully and very narrowly so that it deals with, I mean, I don't know exactly how I would do it, but one suggestion has been if you're going to raise taxes to balance the budget, you have to have a two-thirds majority vote of the House and the Senate. If you're going to reduce spending, but it's a way of balancing the budget, you only need a simple majority. Maybe that's the way to do it. But we need to be careful how we do things. Because if you go blindly into this saying, I'm for a balanced budget, and then someone says, great, we'll do that, and then they start raising taxes on you, that's going the wrong direction.
Well, you've noticed even a lot of the guys that say, yeah, they're for spending cuts, then it comes down to, well, now, wait a minute, not in my district. Everybody has to buy into the idea that they've got to reduce spending or freeze it.
I think we ought to do what we've done here in Texas. We have a sunset statute. Every program sunsets after a period of time. You can make it 5 years, 10 years, whatever you feel is appropriate. You have a program that comes in front of you, and it then sunsets. So that means you have to go back to it and look at it from a zero-based budgeting perspective. And from my perspective, what you need to do is you need to first say, okay, does the Congress have the constitutional authority to act on this program? I mean, you take a look at the Department of Education. This is a state's rights issue. Yep. Education should be done at the state and local level. It should not be done at the federal level. What's the president saying? Well, we ought to keep people in school until they're 18. What authority does the federal government have to tell the states, you got to keep people in school until they're age 18? Some kids are homeschooled. In my experience with homeschoolers, at age 16, they've already finished their curriculum.
Hey, I agree. Right? I've interviewed a number of people.
Two of my girls were homeschooled. And whenever we tested them, they always tested 2 grades ahead of their public school counterparts. Now, that's not necessarily saying something about public school. What that's saying is that in public schools, a good part of the teacher's time is spent in crowd control. When you're dealing with your own children doing homeschooling at home, you're able to tailor your teaching to that person where they're coming from. Some are auditory learners, some are visual learners, or both, or some mixture, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you tailor it to the individual student. And that's one of the advantages of homeschooling. And I'm not saying anything bad about teachers here, but I'm saying that to the extent we can get education down to the local level, the better off we are. You take another one example of an area where I don't think we necessarily should be. Housing. We have here in Galveston an issue of the housing. It's all fraught with all kinds of political issues and people coming from different sides. But my question is, where in the Constitution does it say that the federal government should be involved with housing? I don't think it says that. Getting back to my initial point, a measure comes before my committee, whatever committee that might be on. First question is, do we have constitutional authority to act? If we do, then at that point, it's going to be a question of what are the benefits of doing this versus what are the costs? Then I'm not talking just the cost of administering the program. I'm talking about what's the impact on the economy, all right? Yeah. And at that point, you make a decision.
The question, which you mentioned earlier, is do we even have the constitutional authority to do this? And then another one people often neglect is this necessary? Why are we building new buildings to be vacant? And my little mother-in-law from Phoenix, just last week, I interviewed Mayor Jaworski, and she says, George, I don't understand this housing thing. I said, what, which part? I'm not sure anybody does. She said, well, Galveston's too small.
You mentioned Mr. Jaworski. Interestingly enough, this last week, I got 2 phone calls from his office asking me, this is on my personal phone number, asking me whether I was going to support Mr. Jaworski for mayor. I said, well, do you know who you're talking to? The first person said, no, I don't have a clue who I'm talking to, in essence. And I said, well, you're talking to the person who works for the county of Galveston, who runs the elections process in Galveston, and the city has contracted with us to run their election. I feel it would be inappropriate for me to tell you how I would vote and who I would support, because I'm overseeing that election, and that would be completely out of line. Oh, okay, thank you very much. Click. About 2 hours later, I get the same phone call from somebody else from Mr. Jaworski's office. And I said, you know, this is the second phone call I've gotten. The answer is still the same. that it's inappropriate for me, as the person running the election process in the county, who is the contractor for the city, to tell you how I feel. And I'm not going to tell anybody here how I feel. You would think that they would say, okay, take this guy off the list.
That's hysterical. I really was biting my lip.
Let me go over one more thing. You know, we were talking about what things you could cut. Okay. A lot of people say you should cut the Department of Energy. I don't think there's a constitutional hook for the Department of Energy, except for one part of it. That's something I have a personal knowledge of. When I was working on Capitol Hill and working for the Commerce Department, one of the areas I was working for was called the Bureau of Export Administration. It's now called Bureau of Industry and Security. That bureau within Commerce had the responsibility for controlling U.S. exports. We control about 5% of U.S. exports. They're dual-use items, items that have a valid commercial use, but also can be used for nuclear weapons, can be used for biological weapons, chemical weapons, or missile delivery systems. Part of the program of our clearing and licensing these items has to do with going to the various agencies that have expertise. The Department of Energy has the expertise in the nuclear field. I agree with getting rid of the Department of Energy, but in the process of doing that, you need to move that particular section of the Department of Energy to some other place.
Mm-hmm.
You could move it to defense, you could move it a number of other places. But the bottom line is, people who go in and make blanket statements about, well, let's get rid of this, you know, let's get rid of the Commerce Department or whatever, don't understand the role that's played by those agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was there under Nixon administration. Nixon administration wanted to get rid of a lot of different agencies, they wanted to reorganize and whatever. I was at a function here in Galveston when Mr. Obama said he wanted to make the Small Business Administration a cabinet level agency. Agency. You know, we were asked, what do you think about that? My response to that was, under the Nixon administration, they tried doing that, and what they ended up doing is simply moving the boxes. Nothing got cut. It just moved the boxes around, all right?
I suspect that happens a lot.
So, you know, the bottom line is, we need to look at serious cuts. You know, I was talking about balanced budget earlier. I feel that part of a balanced budget amendment should include, or at least the legislation, should include setting aside a certain percentage, maybe 5%, I don't know, of whatever our income is to pay down that debt. Because if we don't start seriously cutting and paying down the debt, we're never going to get out of this. You just got to stop it. Now, another issue that I think is important, if I can keep going, is border security. This is another issue of this campaign. There was a law that was signed in, Congress passed it, and the president signed it around December of this last year, which gives American armed forces the authority to detain U.S. citizens. You know, they don't have the right to an attorney. They can send them to Gitmo or wherever they're going to send them. That, to me, is a serious breach of individual liberty. I would have opposed that. And some people are saying, you know, put the troops along the border. If you have that authority to do that for U.S. citizens as part of that, then I would not be in favor of that. What I would be in favor of is empowering all levels of law enforcement in this country to be able to enforce all the laws of the country. So a sheriff could enforce the immigration laws. A city police officer could. You could move more border patrol in from other parts of the country and beef that up as well. You've heard the adage that says, when you subsidize something, you get more of it. Well, what do we subsidize? We subsidize food stamps. We subsidize education. We subsidize health care.
Housing, right? Unemployment.
Whatever. Okay.
Yeah, right.
For people who are here illegally. That needs to stop.
Well, that's an incentive.
So, you know, you need to stop that incentive, stop that subsidy, because that's part of what's drawing it. But in addition to that, we're not drawing just people who want to come here because it's, you know, it's a good life. We're drawing people who are criminals, drug dealers, terrorists. We need to stop these people. Now, the other thing we need to do is I would propose that we cut off all federal funding for any city, town, county, or whatever that calls itself a sanctuary city. We have cities in the state of Texas who call themselves that, as well as in California and other places. Any city like that, we should say, okay, you want to be a sanctuary city? Fine. No federal funding to you. Period. They might think twice about that then. Now, in addition to that, we need to deal with the issue of the anchor baby issue. And what I would propose we do is we say that it had to be a constitutional amendment again. Unfortunately, a lot of this stuff has to be constitutional amendments. But what I would propose is that we say that if you're born in the United States, parents who are not here legally, then you would not be a U.S. citizen. Constitution currently says no matter what circumstance you're here, you're a U.S. citizen. I would say if your parents are here illegally, then you would not be a U.S. citizen. I'm personally acquainted with this because we lived in Northern Virginia. We had a couple that were here from the Ivory Coast. And Hillary was born in the United States to parents who were not U.S. citizens, but they were here on student visas. They were here legally. She is and should be a U.S. citizen. they went back to the Ivory Coast. And you know, and all the rioting and the revolt was going on, Hillary and her mother were in danger. Their life was in danger. And so the U.S. Embassy said, she's a U.S. citizen, get her out of the country. And they flew him out of the country. She got here, and they were only here on a temporary visa. In other words, the mother was here on a temporary visa. Hillary was, of course, a U.S. citizen. Well, you're not going to send the mother back and leave her 8-year-old kid here. I was talking earlier about Frank Will. We worked with Frank Will's office. We were able to, because of what was going on in the Ivory Coast, get asylum for the mother. The mother is now working toward being a U.S. citizen, and we were able to do that for her. But the bottom line is, Hillary was a U.S. citizen and should be because mm-hmm. she was here, born to parents in this country when the parents were here legally. People who are not here legally, they should not have that right.
We all got to cut. We all got to share the wealth or share the pain, whatever. How does a guy like you get in there and then get people to look at this stuff and get everybody on the same page?
Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to get elected.
Good point.
And there are 10 people in a race of which I am one. Again, I said, you know, they're all nice people. I happen to think I'm the only real viable candidate, but of course I'm a little biased.
But you were so gentle the way you said that.
You know, I mean, I don't believe in negative campaigning. I was at a candidates forum a while back, and one of the people said, pointing at me, was saying, well, I don't have 20 years experience in Washington, and I'm not part of the problem. I let that pass. But what that said to me was, gee, I really am a viable candidate. Because people who go after you are saying, this guy's a threat to me. So from my perspective, I'm running a campaign that's going to give a choice to people. All right, the choice is, do you want the experience? Do you want a person who stands on principle, who has integrity, and who has a record of that, and does not have any special interest in backing him, and who will represent the people of this district? Let me tell you something else that I want to do that kind of fits into that. The office for the congressman here in Galveston is in the federal building. You got to go into the federal building, you got to get searched and to get to the congressman's office. Well, from my perspective, I would much prefer, I will come back here as often as I can. As long as the legislative schedule allows it, I'll be back here because my family's still going to live here. So I'll come home. And what I want to do is go to someplace like the diner on 61st Street or IHOP somewhere or whatever and sit down and say, you know, my office hours are going to be from 9 to 12 and I'll be here in Brazoria County or Jefferson County or Galveston County. And those are my office hours. If you need to talk to me privately, we can do that separately at a separate time. We can make an appointment to do that. But I want to be able to have my constituents look at me face to face, eyeball to eyeball, and say, Bill, I got a problem, and I need to talk to you about it, and I want to tell you what my issue is. They have the right, I think, to sit down and have a direct conversation with the person who's representing them. And as the person who is representing them, I need to hear what their concerns
sure.
are. Now, I may not agree with what they're saying, but they need to have access. And that's one of the areas that a lot of congressmen don't do. They get up to Washington, they stay up in Washington, they don't come back to their district except when they want to run for election. And that's not the way I'm going to do business. The other thing is that I'm 68 years old. All right. As I said before, I'm not a career politician. I've never run for office before. If I get elected, I don't see myself serving more than maybe 3 terms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that could change, but at this point, I'm going to be 75 at that point, and I don't want to be a Claude Pepper or a Strom Thurmond who wasn't all there except for his body until he died.
Right.
I don't want to be a senile member of Congress. Right? I want to be a person who is on the ball, doing the job I'm supposed to do. And another thing I want to do, this is what I've learned in my experience over the years. I want to help train others to take my job because part of what you do as a congressman can be taught to others.
Mm-hmm.
And as you help others along the way, a lot of members of Congress or people who run for Congress are going there for the wrong reasons. My wife used to work for Jim Baker, chief of staff of the White House. Mm. She worked for him. That's how I met her, Commerce Department.
I'll be.
When he was there. And she had never worked at the White House, but she knew him. And Jimmy tells the story how he walked out of the White House one day on a Pennsylvania Avenue, and he saw his predecessor walking down the street. And the predecessor didn't have anybody oohing and aahing about him. A guy walking down the street. And he said to himself, you know, that's where I'm going to be in a couple of years. Right?
Yeah.
Jimmy Baker was right. Jimmy Baker knew what was right. This did not go to his head. He's a squared away guy who cares about what the job he's doing and doing it right. And he knew that power was not the issue. The issue was being of integrity and doing the job right and being there for a short period of time and then going on and doing something else and letting somebody else take his place. This is something else he did. But one time he called the press into his office as a Secretary of Treasury. I think it was Treasury at the time. And he called the press into his office and he said, guys, I have a story for you, but I need you to hold it until I tell you it's okay to do it. Because if you don't, it's going to have major implications. Promise me not to release it until I tell you. I'll tell you what I need to tell you. Every one of them said yes. Why? because they knew that Jimmy Baker was not going to play fast and loose with them. He was not controlling them. He was not manipulating him. He was giving them a story ahead of time, and they could go home and write it, or go back to their office and write it, but they couldn't release it yet. So he told them what it was that he was going to tell them, and a couple weeks later, he called them up and he said, okay, you can do it now, right? And they did it. But they respected him for that. I want to be a person who's respected, not because I'm important, but because of my integrity. That's where I'm coming from. As I said, there are people who have been looking for this job for a long time and have been campaigning for it. I've been in this campaign for about 45 days. You know, I never really planned on doing this, but we need that integrity. We need the people who agree with the policies of Goldwater and Reagan and Kemp and who have the integrity that they had and that Jimmy Baker's got. That's what we need in Washington. We don't need somebody who sees this as a career move, because I certainly don't see it as a career move. I mean, yeah, it is a career move, but it's not something that I'm going to Washington because it is a career move for me. I'm going to Washington because I want to represent the people who are in this district.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bill Sargent, running for District 14 in the U.S. Congress. How do people find out more about you, your website, phone, any information you want to put out there?
They can go to my website, which is www.BillSargent4Congress.com. They can email me. There's a web form they can contact me with on that site. If they wish to support my campaign, either as a volunteer or by donating, they can do that as well off the website. It's a low-budget campaign for me at this point, because I've just started. All right. There are people who have campaign chests that are over 200,000. That's because they've been working this for a long time. I haven't been. But everywhere I go, I find it really interesting that when I talk to people, almost all of them say, well, I'll vote for you. You're the kind of guy we need in Washington. Yeah, one of the things I say on the website is, if you give me your phone number, I'll call you. I had a guy last night who emailed me, and I called him back, and I talked to him for about a half hour. And, you know, he's calling all the candidates for this office, or he's emailing them, asking them a bunch of questions. The questions were really good, and we talked about them and whatever, about over a half hour. He was amazed that I would spend that much time with him. Well, that's what this is about.
It's about representation.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And keep us posted.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for listening to Electric Theater Radio Hour. Tune in next week at georgedouglaslee.com.